Hi. How's it going? Sorry I was late. I was coming from Bevis Marks tonight. So that happens about once a month. So every now and then I apologize. Seriously, I apologize. Thank you. That was easy. Okay. So we're continuing on tonight. We are hopefully going to complete the first chapter of Deot tonight. And what I want to do is I'd like to open with a bit of retracking what it is that we ended last time with, because, you know, we had 2 weeks of hiatus. And what I'm about to present, we've spoken about a little bit, but only touched on it. So I want to open it up and then go back into it a little bit deeper. What I'm going to present tonight at the opening of the class, our first thought, right? We're going to have basically three sections of tonight's class. Okay, going to be three major ideas that we're going to look at in various modes. The opening is essentially my entire approach to Hilchot Deot. In other words, the way that I read the Rambam through Hilchot Deot. Now, when I say I'm not the only one who reads it that way. And I'll show you sources as I usually do. But what I'm saying is that this is what I would call my mahalach. This is my approach to Hilchot Deot. Right? This is the way that I look at Hilchot Deot and the way that I understand the Rambam's words in Hilchot Deot. So I want to look back at, you have the I'll talk about Deot, we'll look at Deot this way, and then the source sheet. Okay, so there's Deot and the source sheet. The source sheet's up here, or you have it, or it's online. What we mentioned last time was this, right? We were talking about the fact, do I have everyone? Because I'm hearing talking. We were talking about the fact that we are looking at the Deot as a scale, or as a mode of balance, right? And so remember, we looked at the whole room as though we were on the scale, for those of you who were here, yeah? Looked at the whole room as a scale. We were talking about weighting the scale on one side or another. And that what the Rambam was saying to us was that to live on any of those extremes is problematic, right? It's not good. Literally, he says, just it's not a good way to live. He says to tilt on either side, whatever it is that the attribute might be in which we're tilting, could be several attributes in which we're tilting, and where I am more angry than not angry, I am more interested in physical pleasures than not interested in physical pleasures, I am more, whatever the case may be, I'm more arrogant than not arrogant, whatever the case. My goal was to get to the center, what we would call the golden mean, right? Aristotle spoke about the golden mean, yeah? The Rambam certainly may be borrowing the terms of Aristotle, but I don't think, as we're going to see, that he was simply living in Aristotle's head or in Aristotle's speech or thought. HaRambam brings this into Torah very quickly, very quickly. But he does say that we want to live in the middle. And he says that the middle is equidistant. It's equidistant from the ends. It is exactly in the middle, he says. And what I had presented last time, what I had suggested last time, is that what we mean, what the Rambam is saying by talking about the middle, and therefore balancing, so that I'm not tilting under any particular attribute, right? I am not weighted down by my anger, by my licentiousness, by my desire, by my arrogance, by my whatever the case may be, on one way or another, yeah, I'm not weighted by it. I find myself at equilibrium, in charge, so to speak. Right? I'm in balance, and I emerge in that space at that point. What do I mean, I emerge? My identity, me. Without the encumbering elements of my attributes, I emerge. Now you'll wonder, well, what are you if not your attributes? You know, right? I mean, that's an important question. The way that I differentiated was I used the term drives, the modern term drives. The reason why I use the term drives is because the whole concept of drives, and the reason why we call it drives, is because they drive us. We feel driven by these things. What does that mean? I mean, obviously, if we use that term, we use those terms often, we use them in our everyday language, we obviously recognize that there is me, and there are drives, and there are drives driving me, unless you just are those drives. Yes? Somebody say no? No? Right, okay. I mean, if no, no. I mean, you can disagree. That's fine. I'm simply saying that we perceive ourselves as a self, as a meta-self, as an overarching self that deals with the issues of our drives. We understand that there are situations in life, we all understand on some level or another, that there are situations in life where I am driven to do or not do something which the overarching me will judge as being impertinent. I want the chocolate cake. Do you want the chocolate cake? Yes, I do. Do you? Well, is it you or is it the drives that want the chocolate cake? And you know, it's an amazing thing because the minute that you start to talk about yourself in those terms, the whole perception changes. If you don't say, I want, but it wants, it suddenly reframes the entire thing in your mind. It may win, but it reframes the whole thing in your mind. So the idea here, which is very clear, and the Rambam is placing it out, and why I'm saying you emerge at the point of equilibrium is because we find in our lives that we are in constant struggle. There are elements in life which I desire for my ultimate self, my overarching self, that I nonetheless recognize is in jeopardy, often, with drives that I find myself grappling with. So I know that I have to get up in the morning. I know I have to get up at a certain time in the morning. I don't want to. I don't want to. But you just said you want to get up in the morning. So which is it? And who is it? And what are we talking about? And that's why. In the old cartoons, you had the little devil and the little angel on people's shoulders. And the question is, who do I listen to? I mean, this is the oldest thing in the book. Did you have a question?
When you talk about drives, are you talking about the conscious and the unconscious mind?
I'm talking about more than the unconscious mind, and I'll get into this a little bit more. I'm talking about more the amygdala and the what we call the reptilian brain, right? The element of our brains that almost works automatically in order to be able to ensure survival. So if you look at, I don't want to jump ahead a little bit too far. We'll get into that, right? So when I'm talking about the unconscious, I'm not really referring to the unconscious when I talk about drives. There may be intuitions that we have, ideas, feelings that we have that come from the unconscious that are not the same as what it is that I'm referring to when I talk about primal drives. Yeah? Which is a very good question because we have to differentiate between those things. It may not be tonight that I differentiate between those things. So I'm going to focus on some other points of thought in the brain. But thank you for that question. Thank you for that. So when I talk about me, I'm talking about the overarching self that judges what it is that I'm doing. All of us have that in our brains, right? We all have that in our minds. We all have that voice as to what it is that I'm doing and thinking, right? Can we all not think about what we're thinking about? Everybody laughs when I say it, but it happens all the time. We think about what we're thinking about. We think about the fact that I'm thinking about what I'm thinking about. Where is that? What is going on with regards to that? When I am eating the chocolate cake and enjoying the chocolate cake, there's still an overarching thing saying, you will be sorry for this tomorrow morning on the scale. Where is that coming from? Right? That's there somewhere. And what I am suggesting is that we all of us relate to that overarching thought as the core self. Now, there are those among us who are so uncomfortable with the cognitive dissonance that occurs within us because of that overarching self and the drives that I have to deal with. We will shut that up and convince ourselves that I am not that. It's a nuisance that I'm my drives. And it's not all on or off. There are grades, shades as to how much we identify with my drives and what it is that I want, need to have, wish to have, and what I know to be best for my ultimate self. We are at constant odds. So when I reach a point of equilibrium with any of those elements, they may not always be. I may be on equilibrium with one thing, and all the rest, I'm a mess, right? But this I can manage. You know, when it comes to chocolate cake, that I can manage. Yeah? Okay. Ice cream is a whole other story. But chocolate cake I can manage. So I'm right there. When it comes to chocolate cake, I mean, it's always me. It's, you know, do I want it? Do I not want it? Do I feel like having a taste? I don't feel like having a taste. Am I interested? Can I afford the calories? Can I not afford the calories? That's all a question, right? I mean, this is literally every single day of our lives. Okay, but those questions that I'm so coolly entertaining happen only at the place of equilibrium because I'm not being pulled. I'm judging the issue. I'm weighing the cake on my scales, figuratively, literally. Maybe I get a scale out, I decide how much cake I can afford, and so on and so forth. But at the place of equilibrium, I emerge. I am looking at my drives, my needs, my wants, and here's the key, so pay close attention. I am determining how I shall use them as the circumstance requires. I am determining how I shall use them as the circumstance requires, at least in my understanding of the circumstance. I will make the judgment on whether to give that drive what it is seeking or not, based on my assessment of the situation and what is best for me in the situation at hand, the people I'm dealing with, so on, so forth. Sometimes I miss the mark. That's what Yom Kippur is for, right? But that's... Now, if I am working from that place, I am not weighted under the drives. I'm driving. I'm in the driver's seat. I want to make it quite clear, because someone raised this with me since last we met. When I say that I am weighted under the drives, I'm not saying that I don't have choice. Of course, I always have choice. That meta self, the overarching self, is always there. It's always there. It's just a question of the weight under which that self needs to manage itself. How much weight am I dealing with? How serious is the cake in my life? That's a different question. I always have a choice. That choice never goes away. I want to make that abundantly clear. The Rambam agrees. Otherwise, there's nothing to talk about. I mean, I have to make the initial choice to stop being weighted under the cake in the first place in order to be able to even begin to find equilibrium. Yes? Okay, so there is the capacity to choose. And that's the case even with somebody who might be an addict. Someone needs to make the choice to go to the 12-step program. They may not like the 12-step program. It may take them a long time to get through the program, but at the end of the day, the choice needs to be made. A choice needs to be made to find a sponsor. A choice needs to be made to call the sponsor. And so on and so forth. That's got to happen. There may be support for that, and we're going to find later on in Hilchot Deot that there's room even for support. You need help. That's a whole second chapter. The whole second chapter is you're sick. No, we don't mean physically sick. You're spiritually sick, right? Why? Because you're weighted under some stuff that's having problems. You're having problems. So go see a doctor. The doctor in this case is the Hacham. Now, the question is, who's the Hacham? So the Rambam defines the Hacham as follows. Let's take a look, okay? That's where I want to come to. Take a look at the very end of Dalet. Just before Hey, right? So you're looking at the last lines of Dalet in the Deot, in the text. So on the second side. He says at the last line, Kol Adam, you see Kol Adam, see where he starts umishehu?
No.
In the text, on the sources, in the ot, in the ot. I'm going to call this the text, the text. This is the text, the text, the text, the text. Okay? Come on, come on. There's only two, there's only... This isn't complicated. All right? So you're going to look at... Can I have your attention, please? We're looking at number... see where number five is? It starts a person or he umishu medagdek. Go up 1.5 lines. Okay? You see kol adam shedeotav. Every person whose traits are intermediate and equally balanced is not can be called, forgive me, that's not, it's is called wise. Nikra hacham. That person is called a hacham. That means that a person who has managed to work on oneself to the point that that overarching self is in charge of that life, that's a hacham. I explained why at the end of last week's class, last time's class, why I brought the words of Rav Nachum Rabinovich. And he says that if I understand my circumstances and I understand me in terms of those circumstances and I am in control of me in terms of those circumstances and I choose how it is that I'm going to act given my understanding of myself in the circumstance, I'm a wise man or woman. I understand my circumstance, I understand me, and I am in a place that I am able to act in the way that I need to, or the circumstance requires me to, for the best benefit of myself and the places, people around me.
Are there any traits which there is no winning point? You should always try and strive for...
Very good question. We're going to wait for that till next time. Yeah? That's in second chapter. Okay? Right now, we only know one thing. Equilibrium means I'm in control of myself. Okay? So I want you... Oh, you're... No? You're okay. Okay. So, we need Margaret. So, I want to take a look at the source sheet. To be able to see this in the source sheet. Number one on the source sheet comes from, this is also the Rambam, but this is coming from the Rambam's introduction to Ethics of the Fathers, to Pirkei Avot. And in the Ethics introduction, he talks about these ideas. He talks about what it means to be a hacham, what it means to find the middle path, what it means not to be weighted on one side or another in terms of my drive. And he says, "Im haya adam shokel ma'asav tamid." Notice the language, shokel. Shokel means literally to weigh. Yeah, mishkal is a weight or a balance, yeah, a scale. "Im haya adam shokel ma'asav tamid umitkaven la'matzoa." And he intended to find the middle point, right? So he's weighing himself on the scale. He's weighing these attributes on his figurative scale, trying to find equilibrium. He's looking for equilibrium, yeah? He goes, if that person is capable of finding equilibrium, in where that person is the driver and the master rather than being driven, that is the highest level of humanity that a person can achieve. So we've shot that up immediately, very, very high. I mean, you know, it's nice to talk about it, but once we actually come to terms with what this means, it's not an easy thing. Highest level. Ubikach yitkarev lifnei Adonai. And through that, says Harambam, you bring yourself close to God. You stand before God. We're going to talk about why that is later on, but that's how he explains this. So that's already bringing it into what it means to be related to God, connected to God, and why that relates to my own behaviors and attributes. The most wholesome, complete service of God is to get yourself to this point. That's a remarkable line. The Rambam is saying that the highest level of service to God is to be in a state where you are the driver of your own attributes in life. And you're not driven or pulled.
וכבר הזכירו החכמים זה העניין זה, זה לשונם בו, אמרו כל השם אורחותיו זוכה ורואה ביש האלוהים.
That a person who measures his path will see the salvation of God. Why? Because they're connected. They've set up their own life so that they're able to have a relationship and connection with God. So that's the first thing. I'm simply showing that the Rambam connects this. He says this several times. But what I want to look at is not just the Rambam. I want to see that this concept of at the point of equilibrium, I am weighing and I am not tilting under the weight of my own attributes is a concept in Torah that the Hachamim speak about. So we'll look pre-Rambam, Rabbeinu Saadia Gaon. Rabbeinu Saadia Gaon in the Emunot V'Deot. He talks about love, and he talks about hate, he talks about kindness, and he talks about evil, and so on and so forth. He talks about the different attributes. And he says as follows. He says, when you're dealing with these things, I'm going to start from the middle here. He says, when you're dealing with these things, יהיה כאילו הביאם לפני הדיין ודן עליהם. Which means when you're dealing with the question of your own love, and your own hatred, your own likes and your own dislikes, your own passions and your own difficulties, your own drives. Let it be as though you are bringing it before a judge and judging them. What does that immediately do? What is it?
Externalizes.
It externalizes it and it puts you where? It puts you in the seat of judgment. So you are immediately pulling yourself out of being driven and establishing yourself as the judge or as the driver, determining how fast you're going to drive, where you're going to turn, so on and so forth. That's why I'm saying the first step in even beginning to do this is our rhetoric, is the language that we use. I want or it wants. You may feel that, you know, there's a little schizophrenia going on, God forbid, right? But don't. All of us have that problem. We have a whole bunch of stuff going on, right? All different personalities going on in our heads, right? That's why we always talk to ourselves. Is it just me? Just me? Yeah? Everybody talks to themselves. Every single person talks to themselves. You may just not do it out loud. You think to yourself, what am I going to do today? Okay, I got to do this and this today. Who are you talking to? Stop talking to yourself. Just do it. But we do. We think about, what am I going to do today? Where do I need to go? Did I do this yet? Did I got to call mom? Got to do anything? All right. We all do that. Who are you talking to? There's no other person there. So you say, well, that's just thinking. No, it's not just thinking. It's talking. In your head, to yourself. There's a reason we do that. Because there's two people there. So what I'm trying to say over here is, all one needs to do to begin the first steps into managing the driver's seat as opposed to being driven, is to question instead of I want, it wants or I want. It's not the end and it's not the answer, but it changes things very majorly. And you will be surprised, I'm telling you, you will be surprised if you begin to do this, how different the battle becomes, should you wish to engage in the battle at all. You will immediately realize that this is a very, because you're completely resetting the entire board as to what's going on over here. It's not I want. And I know that it's not I want because I'm not going to be thrilled with myself tomorrow morning. Well, who's you and being thrilled and with who and with what? What are we talking about? Well, obviously, we've got dual situations going on over here. You might as well talk to yourself that way and recognize that it's not you, that it's it. And the reality is it, which I'll explain in a moment. It's not just a nice little, vernacular thing. It's not a little language trick. It's the truth. So what the Rabbeinu Saadia is saying is always look at things as though you are judging the appropriateness of an action here. like you are a judge in a courtroom. Now it is possible, just like we have to do with judges, and we have to tell them not to take bribes. It's possible when I first sit as a judge in this case, I will be prone to taking bribes. Not only will I be prone to taking bribes, which is the most overt problem, I might be influenced by the circumstance in front of me. So the Torah says, we just read this last week, the Torah tells me, 2 weeks ago, the Torah tells me, if there is a poor person sitting in your courtroom, be careful not to favor his judgment if he's not the one that should be favored. Well, your heart's going to go out to him. You're going to feel terrible about the fact that he really isn't the right one over here. I can't award him the money. He's going to walk out as destitute as he was before he walked into the courtroom. Maybe more, because at least he thought he maybe had a chance here. And the Torah goes out of its way to tell us, Lo tehedardal, you are not allowed. Be careful. Do not award that poor person anything that isn't coming to him. Empathy, lovely. Lack of justice, not okay. Do not do it. So good. So now in your internal courtroom, you're deciding whether I should get angry here or not get angry here. And there's just this tremendous pull, right? You know, it just feels so good to get angry at this person. As a matter of fact, it makes my week to get angry at this person. But a week later, I might feel bad about it. And, you know, just wonder, like, really, how long am I going to go on like this, getting angry? So it's quite complicated, but this is the way that we're supposed to look at it. And the only way that I can really look at it without bias is to be in the middle, is to find a place in terms of my own person in where I am not pulled by these things. I find equilibrium. Let's look at the Chovat HaLevavot, Rabbeinu Bahya ben Pakuda. Also, that's number 3, right? That's also pre-Rambam. The Harambam writes that his father, Rabbi Maimon, had this book on his desk at all times. Rabbeinu Bahya ben Pakuda's Chovot HaLevavot, never left his table. Rabbeinu Bahya, he writes in dialogue between the soul and the mind, right? The soul being the undeveloped element of sense and feeling, and the mind being the intellect, the awareness, the meta-self, yeah? And the nefesh has been studying from the sechel, the soul has been studying from the intellect and the mind. And it comes to a point in where he understands, the soul understands, I need to judge my attributes. I have to actually judge how it is that I'm going to act. So he poses the following question. Shir, neshama. Kvar havinoti ma'amarecha v'ekshavti l'kol ma shezachati. He says, I've listened to everything you've said. V'ani mithanenet el kevodcha. I am begging your honor. She's saying to him. Tell me the places in which I should use my attributes in praiseworthy fashion and in fashion that is unacceptable or not praiseworthy. Use them. Tell me how I should use them. So we have a person who is recognizing attributes that one holds as tools to behavior, not me, but my tools for engagement. I am asking, how do I use them? That's the language that's brought over here. And that's all Harambam is saying. Harambam is saying, you want to know how you end up at a point where you can actually ask that question and see it? Find equilibrium. Because otherwise, that's not a question. It's using you. And you find yourself under the weight of whatever attribute you're dealing with. And we have many. This concept, very important, this concept, remember we opened with a mitzvah. Remember? We opened with a mitzvah. Does anybody remember the mitzvah that we're examining now in the first few chapters? Thank you very much. V'halachta bidrachav. You walk in his way. This too is walking in his way. This too, finding equilibrium, and choosing how it is that you are going to act in a given situation, giving your attributes, using your attributes for the purpose, that's walking in the way of God. Why? That's what he does. This the Rambam writes in the Moreh Nebuchim. Let's have a look at the Moreh Nebuchim. All right, the Moreh Nebuchim is number 5. Yeah, we'll do another one. He says, one thing that we need to know about God is that God acts. In the source sheets, number 5. Is that God acts. But God acts simply as an expression of what God is. Right? So everything that God does is truth. Right? We act in a bit of a different fashion. We act by having attributes, and we choose to engage those attributes which are inherently within us, and we choose how it is that we're going to use them and calibrate them and so on and so forth. He says the way that we should act, if we are of a high level, and we're going to see how high the level he thinks this is in a minute, is that we should always judge the situation and use our attributes accordingly. Because why? That's how God does it. It's the way that God runs the world. God runs the world not in terms of himself. God runs the world in terms of us. Interacts with us in terms of us. Talks to us in terms of us. Engages with us in terms of us and our needs and what he deems to be best and so on and so forth. That's v'halachta b'drachav. Now, of course, I mean, you know, it's not God being fully God in the sense that God's not unleashing and just simply doing whatever it is that comes to him, so to speak. There's a certain level of covenant that's engaged. And the level of covenant is, I'm engaging with you qua you and what it is that you need. I'm engaging with you as per what works with this relationship. So we understand in that setting, right, how sophisticated that is. Because we all understand how difficult relationships are. And learning not only how to act in terms of the given circumstance, but in terms of a relationship. Not what do I feel like doing with this person, but what is necessary for me to do and say in order to be able to engage in a relationship with this person that is functional, that works, that is manifesting in a healthy capacity. Yeah? 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 So take a look. Beautiful line. Beautiful from the Moreh. He says, I'm going to start over here. Because he talks about God and he says, look, the way that God runs, there's nothing in addition to God. God is all he is. And so whatever happens from God is just God stuff. Right? So he's not, he's not using attributes per se. It's just interacting with truth. And so our interactions with truth feel different depending on how we are and what's going on, the circumstance and so on and so forth. But what comes from God is God. He says, by us, however, Ra'ui l'menhiga medina imhaya navi. Very interesting. He says, a person who is running a group of people. Medina means government, basically. Right? Whatever level of government. It could be family government. It could be community government. It could be country government. Whatever the case may be. If this person is a Navi, says the Rambam, Navi meaning a prophet, yeah, interesting. I mean, all of a sudden we've jumped to having the head of this Medina, a prophet. He goes, well, if the person is a prophet, right, you know how they should run things. Because what the Rambam is saying over here is in the ideal situation, if this person is of the highest levels of humanity, the way that they should run the situation is, لِدَمُوت بَتُوَارِيمَ إِلَى, they should resemble God in this sense, he says. And how is he resembling God? Yasu al yado peulot elu bemida ubemi shiraui lekach. He should act in terms of what the situation requires and with whom is appropriate to act in such a way. Lo mitoch stam itpa'alut, not from simple movement, meaning not simply because they are driven to act in a particular way. Rather, an assessment of the situation and the person. V'lo yishahrer mosrot ha-kaas, he should never release the restrictions of kaas, of anger. Mosrot ha-kaas, another way of understanding, he should never release the discipline of anger, meaning using anger as discipline, meaning of his own anger that's uncontrolled. Yeah? Al yiten li'itpa'aluyot li'ishtaresh bo, you should never allow for the drives to find root in him. Ki kol hatpa'alut ra'a. Anytime that you allow yourself to be driven, it's a bad thing. It's a pretty serious statement. Right? Have I got you? All right, looking at the time. The Rambam says, in number 11, on the source sheet, is that this is what a prophet is. This is the definition of a person who is prepared for prophecy. That what? En hanevuah hala, second line, you see? En hanevuah hala, prophecy will only rest on a person who mitgaber bedaato al yitzro, excuse me, I'm missing, I skipped it. Ela al hacham gadol b'chokhma gibor b'midotav. A person who is a great hacham, meaning he is gibor b'midotav, he has full strength and control over his attributes. That's how we define hacham, remember? Hacham is a person who has reached equilibrium, who has full control over his attributes, and he says what? Lo yehe yitzro mitgaber alav b'davar ba'olam. His drives, his inclinations, never get the best of him with any issue. Elahu mitgaber b'da'ato al yitzro tamid. He, instead, overcomes his yetzer, his inclinations, always. This is very explicit over here. It's talking about who's overcoming who, which is overcoming what. The prophet is always the one who overcomes. I'm leaving it here, not going too further into it because I'm sensitive to the time. So you see this. It's the person who gets close to God. The person gets close to God in this capacity because this person is a person. The soul is manifesting, not the drives. And once a person is whole and complete, not dealing with external pulls, but that person is in charge, that person is what God created in terms of the wholeness and fullness of a person. That person can get close to God. That's why the Rambam in the Halachot, and take a look, in the end of number 4, paragraph 4, or at least on the first page of paragraph 4 in the text, Fichach, in the last three lines, Ufichach Tzavu, and in the English it's therefore the early sages instructed. You have that in the text? Therefore commanded us to constantly assess our path. Am I tilting or am I finding equilibrium? And if I'm tilting, how do I get to equilibrium? Why? Make sure that you aim it b'derech ha'emtza'it, find middle, kedeh sheyeh shalem, so that you can be whole. So that's what we're looking for. Yeah. Questions up until this point? For clarity, I'm not talking about questions in terms of just if there's anything that's unclear yet.
Rabbi, can I ask you?
Yeah.
Are you talking about control? Where does control come in?
Thank you for asking that question. Am I talking about control? And I'm going to elaborate on your question with your permission. You can tell me if I'm going in the wrong direction. Are we talking about control? Or are we talking about mastery? Two are not the same. Mastery. What do I mean? Mastering something. Control can very well mean I'm in the driver's seat, but I'm not pushing the gas pedal, right? I'm not the one that's putting the accelerator. I'm not the one that's necessarily deciding, you know, how fast and what kind of movement the car is taking. I'm just trying to drive it away from a brick wall. But I'm driving. So on a certain level, I'm in control. But you would recognize that that is extremely different from me deciding how much gas to give, when to how much pressure to put on the accelerator, when to push off, when to turn the car on, when to turn the car off, when I'd like to turn and how I'd like to turn, rather than turning in a way that I don't tip over, and so on. At the beginning, it's control, because I'm being driven. It comes to a point in where I become closer and closer, I get closer and closer to mastery. in where I genuinely turn on and off the drives as I need. But I'm going to talk about that probably now. I'm looking at the time, and because I was late, I'm going to probably talk about that at the beginning of next week. I want to finish with the following this week. Okay? So what I'm going to talk about next week, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to talk about next week. What I'm going to talk about next week is the next step. Once a person reaches the level of chokhmah, which may very well be a certain level of control, right? I'm in equilibrium, but I'm constantly holding myself here, right? I may still be on the scale myself. But at least I'm on a place where I'm balancing, and I know I'm not tilting too much, and I'm not tilting too much there, and I can have some clarity at this point, right? Up, I get a little bit off this way, or up, I get a little off that way, and I try and find myself back into balance. It's like riding a bike. Yeah? That's a better analogy for this particular thing. So to ride a bike, I need to be able to balance. But there's riding a bike and there's riding a bike. Right? I mean, I can ride a bicycle and kind of like keep myself up and have to keep going and whatever it is, you know. And we know the difference between a person who knows how to ride a bike and a child or whoever it is that's learning how to ride a bike. And that person who's learning how to ride the bike is managing to keep steady for a little bit, but doesn't necessarily yet know what it feels like to be balanced. And once we do, it's second nature. And the Rambam actually says that. He says it comes to a point where it's second nature. Living a balanced life is second nature. Then the question is only, well, should you tilt here or not? That becomes a question. You want to do some stunts on the bike? Well, you better really know what your equilibrium is. And so the question then becomes, once I reach chokhmah and I know how to ride a bike, and I'm a chacham on the bike, there's such a thing called hasid on the bike. A hasid may choose to ride at a tilt for various reasons. But the difference between the hasid and a person who's trying to simply get off the tilt is the hasid can tilt at will because his place of equilibrium is intact. So the hasid can tilt at will as necessary. As a matter of fact, he can live quite a bit of time on a tilt if he wishes to, because that's better for him in his relationship with God and so on and so forth. But you don't do that until you know how to ride a bike. Otherwise, you look like the kid who's just tilting all over the place, but it's not because he wants to tilt, he just can't help it. We're not talking about that tonight. We'll talk about that next week. What I want to finish with tonight is this. It's all very nice to talk about this. It is extremely difficult to do this. The difficulty cannot be overestimated. I mean, overstated. Cannot be overstated. And here I want to talk a little bit about, you know, my whole amygdala prefrontal cortex situation. Because what we're dealing with in our brain are two, I mean, we're dealing with more than two structures, but we're focusing now on two major structures of the brain. One that they call the amygdala, part of the limbic system of the brain, and one is the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is also called the new brain. The reason why it's called the new brain is because we're like the only ones that have it, human beings. No one else really has the developed new prefrontal cortex that the human being has. No other primates, they may have some initial development, but certainly nothing near our brains, right? Which is what allows us to do everything that allows us to do. I mean, things that are uniquely human. The limbic brain, the amygdala that's part of the limbic brain, is very different. It's old. It's shared across species. And it is responsible for primal survival. It is responsible for my fear, which signals me to either get out of a dangerous situation. It is responsible for my fight, which means signals me to fight, secure a situation. It's responsible for my feeding, which is simply the need and move and drive, the capacity to be able to find the energy that I need in order to be able to survive. If you've ever watched National Geographic or Blue Planet or anything with David Attenborough, you know that the bottom line is you're always watching an animal trying to find food. And the other question is trying to mate. And that's the last thing that it does. It's procreation. It's survival, survival, survival. We don't think about those things. We are driven towards those things. The planning and the questioning and all of that is when the prefrontal cortex gets in the way of the amygdala doing its job. The amygdala is also called the reptilian brain, because we share an element of it with the reptile. And that's why it's called old. It's just all over the place. And even the Hachamim look at it this way. The Hachamim talk about the human being as coming after the mosquito. You know, this is, says, look, don't get so high and mighty on yourself. You came after the mosquito, all right? The mosquito was first in the development of things. So it's very new. The whole human thing is very new. But this element of our brain, we share across species. It is responsible for the most primal drives and primal elements of who we are. That's why you think there's a snake at the beginning of the story? Because that's what we're dealing with. There's a snake at the beginning of the story. And that's why you call human beings snakes. Not in this room. I'm just saying that we call human beings snakes. Reptiles. Right? Because we still have those elements within us. And if we give in to those elements, we act that way. I'm not going into a whole lesson as to what that is. But understand, that's why it's in the story over there. And why it's external to us on that level of reality. In Gan Eden, it doesn't live inside of us. It lives external to us. The human does not have that inside. It's external. It's talking to me from the outside. It's only here that it has an internal element of my being. But it's the it, not the I. And that's something we must understand as human beings. The prefrontal cortex is responsible for our feelings, for our planning, for our thought, for our capacity to ask, what if? Which is massive, which takes away the whole question of the difference between a human being and every other animal on this planet. We just know how to ask, what if? We don't have to wait until we end up getting enough fur so that we can live in the North Pole. And enough whatever it is else that we need. We make a jacket. You know, a very heavy jacket, or whatever the case may be. Because we have the capacity to think in those terms. Now, when you connect both, the question, of course, is who's in charge? The amygdala or the prefrontal cortex? Which is in charge? Guess which one is older and has veto power? The amygdala. All you need to do is be afraid. And guess who's in charge? Any element of fear. That whole planning thing and the equilibrium and the rational thing, it's out the window. Even a person who knows how to ride a bike, if you scare that person for any reason, they're off. We lose our... We freeze when we're afraid. So does every animal in the jungle freeze when it's afraid. Or it runs away, or it learns that it needs to fight. But just loses it. It just loses it. There is no question of, what should I do now? That's not there in fear. Do you know what the Hachamim call the inclination that drives all of this in us? An old, ignorant king. Why ignorant? Not a lot of thought going on in the amygdala. Really not a lot of thought. It's just, I want, I have. I need, I take. I'm angry, I yell. I'm hungry, I eat. I feel like I want something, I have it. And then there's a question of conflict, right? You know, I mean, I feel like I want this and I don't want that. Well, all right, which one is the stronger drive in this particular situation? That's not a choice. That's not a thoughtful question. It's just giving into a drive. That's all. It's just a question. Which one is wrong? What do you think? Dogs don't go through those questions? Of course they do. Every animal goes through those questions on one level or another. And so do we. The question is, who is running it? So the Hachamim say, that's an old ignorant king that we're dealing with. Why a king? Because it's always got us under its control. Always. Where's my thing with the king? My thing with the king. Where's the king? Where's the king? Where's the king? Where's the king? Yeah, 10. Number 10 on the source sheet. Sorry, it's number 9 over here. All right, number 9 over here. It says, Tov yeled misken vehacham. Better to have a child that is a poorly child, but intelligent and wise. Here we have chacham again, right? Young, but wise. Than to have a king that is old and stupid. Why? He says, what's Tov Yeled? That's a pasuk. That's a line in Kohelet, right? In Ecclesiastes, King Solomon. Tov Yevus Gevur Chacham Dechachamim, you say that's the Yetzirah Tov. The young, wise person is the prefrontal cortex. It's the thoughtful, judging, rational part of ourselves. It's young. Say the Chachamim, it's young because it comes into us later in life. It's not there as a child. As a child, we still have the very early elements of the brain running. The prefrontal cortex, you know how old a person is before the prefrontal cortex is fully developed? 24. 24 years old. Everybody under that is a child. We hope 24. We hope 24. Right? But that's why, under 24 years old, I mean, listen, cut them some slack. They don't even have a full brain running. Right? They just don't. I mean, you know, it's getting there. It's getting there, but it's not. So you tell a bar mitzvah kid he's a man. Don't do that. Don't do that. He's not. He is a full-fledged member of the team, but he's not a man, and she's not a woman yet. It takes time, right? Halachically, we don't even punish them until they're 20. In other words, I'm talking about the old core, old school, hardcore, old day punishments, you know, with the lashes and all that business. Yeah, that doesn't happen until a person is 20 years old. At least. So young, that's why the Hachamim say it's young. I'm adding to that, my suggestion to that is, it's young because this part of the brain is young. Whether you look at it in terms of our own development, the element of our brain that is limbic, the amygdala, is fully formed by 8 months in utero. Not 8 months after birth, 8 months in utero, which means that that element of memory and recording already starts from that point of life. So everything that we experience in terms of our senses, what love feels like, not what love thinks like, is already from that point. And we record that on the hard drive. And it sticks on the hard drive. And that hard drive is the thing that has veto power in our lives. Because it's old, but it's also stupid. It doesn't think. It doesn't weigh. It has no capacity to put anything on a scale. That whole discussion that we had at the beginning is not in the capabilities of the amygdala. It doesn't work. It's an old, stupid king. But it's a king because it has us in his grasp and has veto power. It's old not only because it comes into us earlier in life, it's old because it's been in the world longer. However it is that you want to look in the world, whether you want to recognize it in terms of evolutionary terms, you want to look at it just simply in terms of 6 days of creation, doesn't matter because the Hachamim talk about it. And the Hachamim say, you were preceded by a mosquito. Bottom line, whatever they came in with is older than what you've got. So whatever you have that matches that, well then fine, but it's older. And it's got veto power. The young, intelligent part, which is our good parts, which is our capacity to be able to question, what do I want for myself in my life? What do I want to choose? And ultimately, how will I weigh? And what's required of me? And how shall I choose my anger and my arrogance and all of that? All of that exists here. Ultimately, we look at it as existing in the soul. It's me that emerges in equilibrium. It is difficult to manage because when you have an amygdala that is old and is a king and has veto power and get this, and is now wired to your prefrontal cortex, don't think that it doesn't use the prefrontal cortex for its own purposes. So you know what we call that when the amygdala uses the prefrontal cortex for its purposes? Rationalization. That's what we call it. We make it okay. You know who makes it okay? It does. Because it's in charge. And it's got this whole new playing machine called the prefrontal cortex. So it finds phenomenal reasons for everything it wants. Phenomenal reasons. The smarter you are, the worse it is. You always find a reason why. Always. You don't have to think. And I want to pause here. I want to stop here. Because I cannot tell you how important what I just put out is. If you, again, I know I do this sometimes, but I do it consciously. If you come out with nothing other than that tonight, that's what you want to take with you. Don't forget everything else. I'm just telling you, that's what you want to take with you. Rationalization is our its needs, using our own thinking and mind for its purposes. It's the serpent or snake using the wisdom of a human being for its own purposes. It happens without thinking, by definition. Because if we stop to genuinely give some jurisdiction to the overarching self, we really have to question why it is that we're doing it. And is the rationalization that I'm making, no matter how good it sounds, no matter how strong I can make the case, no matter how well I can express the need for that chocolate cake, there is still an element of ourselves that can sit in the judgment seat and judge. Now, it gets very complicated. Because if my brain is an illusion producer, and I'm using that to try and judge my own illusions, gets a little bit complicated. And that is why next week, Harambam, or probably the week after, Harambam says, you need to go to a hacham. You need to hear someone from the outside who's been through this, who can tell you when you're sabotaging yourself, who can tell you straight you're rationalizing. It is the most difficult thing for us to do. I'm going to repeat that. It is the most difficult thing for us to do. And when we think we've got it done, think again. So I want to look at this with you, and then we're going to close. Take a look at number 8. This is the Mesilat Yesharim. Sorry, I don't know why it's different in my book. This is the Mesilat Yesharim. This is Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, mid-1700s. Thrown out of Padua, Italy. I told you a story, yeah? The Mesilat Yesharim in its entirety is a guide to this problem. The whole of the Mesilat Yesharim, literally means the path of the straight, right? Is a detailed treatment of our capacity to rationalize, the formidable veto power of the amygdala, and the need to constantly assess from my prefrontal cortex how it is that I'm dealing with my life in terms of achieving a relationship with God, which ultimately means achieving a relationship with truth. And so he says, Re'eze Matzati, the Hasid is speaking, he says, look, if you want me to be honest with you, I'll tell you. Bechol ayunai, in all of my research, in all that I've studied, in everything that I've seen, Umlechet Pirishuti, and in my work in trying to recognize the needs that I have to differentiate myself from the other things in this world that pull me. En davar kashe ba'olam, katov ha'amiti v'asheremut. There is nothing as difficult in this entire world as achieving truth, wholeness, and genuine good. There are barriers upon barriers in the quest. Kulam hazakim, they are all powerful. Kulam kashim me'od, they are all extremely difficult. Homa gvoha delataim ubriach, they are lofty walls with padlocks and locks upon locks. Asher ha'resh ya'amol ha'adam lehasir harbeh mehem, that just when a person has worked so hard to get one lock off one door, Od yisharu lo harbe yoter. There's plenty more where that came from. Le'as yigo al nachon. Way to end on a high note. We're not ending yet. But that's important. And what he's saying is, don't underestimate. Don't underestimate the depths of primal drives that we deal with and why we want what we want. And whether it genuinely is a seeking of truth or a seeking of my needs. No matter how rational we make it sound, no matter how good, benevolent we make it sound, we have the capacity to do so. So I'm going to end with Rav Huttner. In a beautiful line from Rav Huttner, a beautiful point from Rav Huttner. And that's in number, what is it, 20 or 19 here? I don't know where it is. I hope he has it. I hope we've got it. All the way at the end. Yeah, no? Yeah. Yeah? 19. Okay. Just a bit of background for this, and I promise you we're done here, okay? A bit of background for this. Rav Huttner, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, was the mashgiach of Chaim Berlin Yeshiva in Brooklyn, in New York. Recently, not a long time ago, we're talking about maybe 50 years ago. A great scholar, a profound mind, but a man of great heart. And we have his letters, many of the letters that he wrote to his students and that his students wrote to him. This is a response to a letter from a student. The student is saying to his Rebbe, I am dying here. I am just so overwhelmed with the fight that I'm dealing with in terms of my own drives. And just when I think I've gotten it and I've worked it out, it just keeps coming. And I just don't know what to do, Rebbe. I don't know how to get out from under it. So, I mean, we all have a tendency to feel like that sometimes if we care. Right? If we haven't just written ourselves off, you know, which unfortunately some people do. If there's any element of us left that really does care about these things, we understand this young man who's writing to his Rebbe, who's struggling the way that he's struggling. It's not a religious struggle. This is the struggle of the human soul. This is the struggle of humanity. No matter how far back you go, you will find writings on these issues in some way or another. For Israel, it's a question of our connection with God, and ultimately our connection with truth and being. And so his Rebbe writes back to him. He says, Dalecha Chavivi, know my dearest one. He says to his student. I'm going to step back here so I can read it again. Sheshorish nishmatecha hu lo ha-shalva shel ha-yetzer tov. Because I want you to understand that the source of your soul, meaning the roots of your soul, doesn't live, it's not meant to live in the pristine, sublime joy of your good inclinations. In other words, where you've just got it all worked out, and you know, you're sailing along on this wonderful place. That's not where your soul lives, it's not where your soul comes from. He says, rather, davka milhamto shel ha-yetzer ha-tov. Your soul is born to fight and use in its fight the inclinations that you have for good, which essentially is you. It's the meta-self, right? It's the overarching self that wants its life, that is willing to fight for its life. And so he says, Michtavcha yakar nilvav merid kime'aradim. He says, you know, I want to tell you this letter that you sent me. It testifies like 100 witnesses to me. Ki achen lohem ne'emanata, that you are a noble and formidable warrior. He says, because you wouldn't have written the letter otherwise. You would have just given in. But you didn't. And the very fact that you're writing to me and that you care is like 100 witnesses that you are a faithful and noble warrior. Be'anglit omrim, in English they say, lose a battle but win the war. Which is a great line. It's perfect for this. He says, Bevadai, shincha nichshal ve'omed liot nichshal. He goes, of course, right now you've lost the battle. And you want to know what? He says, you're going to lose more. It's going to happen again and again. In Bazei Mishum Petihat Pilasadan, and he writes in parentheses, he goes, don't worry, I'm not opening my mouth to the devil, you know, when I say that. It's just the way that it is. Bekama Marachoti Pol Shadud, he says, not only that, you want to know what else? There are going to be situations in your war where you will be taken captive and you will be held. Aval ani mavtiach lecha. But I promise you, Shilahar have said, kol hamarachot, after all the battles, you will come out, tetze min hamilchama, you will come out from that war, kishizar hanitzachon al roshecha, with the wreath of victory around your head. And your prey will still be flapping in between your teeth. He says, lose the battle, but win the war. The wisest among men, which is King Solomon, said, Sheva yipol tzadik vakam. He's quoting a pasuk here. 7 times the righteous man falls and gets up. Hatipshim, he says, the idiots think, the definition of that pasuk is Hoshvim ki kavanato bederech rebuta, afal pi shesheva yipol tzadik mikol makom hukam. The people who don't understand think that the meaning of that pasuk is even if the righteous man falls 7 times, he'll get up. That's not the definition of the pasuk. That's not how to understand the pasuk, he says. Rather, the definition of tzadik is that he has fallen 7 times. You don't have a tzaddik that hasn't fallen 7 times. 7, of course, is just a paradigmatic number. Right? There's sub-falls in between those. Aval ha'chamim yodim etev, the wise men know that what he's talking about over here is mahut ha'kimah shel ha'tzaddik hi derech ha'shev nifilot, that the only way that a tzaddik stands is because he's fallen 7 times, in quotation marks. Right? It's not literally 7. V'yarak kol asher asa v'ne tov meod. He sees everything he's done in his life as very good. All of the failures, all of the falls, the battles that he lost. He learned from those battles. And he only stands up because he lost those battles. Tov ze yetzera tov, meod ze yetzera ra. As the Hachamim say, when it says tov meod in Bereshit, tov, that's our good inclinations. Our prefrontal cortex in its best. Meod, very good, that's our drives. Without them, we'd have nothing. In the end of the day, they drive us to good. If we didn't have to fight, if we didn't have to war, if we didn't have to battle, well, there wouldn't be really much of us at all, would there? It's only those things that prompt us to question ourselves, to push ourselves forward, that brings out all of the latent potential within us. So that's the beautiful letter that Rav Huttner writes to his Talmid to give him some strength in his fight that all of us know quite well. All of us know it very well. Next time we're going to talk about some of the great glories of coming out of that war, some of the great ones who have been able to fight valiantly and who have come out of it, and what it is that they do and how it is that they function and what it is that we're supposed to learn from them. And I look forward to seeing you. You'll forgive me for keeping you late and coming late and so on and so forth. It's just one of my things. I apologize. But nonetheless.